Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. To the Hesitating Purchaser. If sailor tales to sailor tunes, storm and adventure, heat and cold, if schooner islands and maroons, and buccaneers and buried gold, and all the romance retold, exactly in the ancient way, can please as me as they pleased of old, the wiser youngsters of today. So be it, and fall on. If not, if studious youth no longer crave, his ancient appetites forgot, Kingston and Ballantyne the brave, or Cooper of the wood and wave, so be it also, and may I and all my pirates share the grave where these and their creations lie. Part 1. The Old Buccaneer. Chapter 1. The Old Sea Dog and the Admiral Benbow. Squire Trelawney and Dr. Livesey and the rest of these gentlemen having asked me to write down the whole particulars about Treasure Island, from the beginning to the end, keeping nothing back but the bearings of the island, and that only because there is still treasure not yet lifted. I take up my pen in the year of grace 17, and go back to the old time when my father kept the Admiral Benbow Inn, and the brown old seaman with the saber cut first took up his lodging under our roof. I remember him as if it were yesterday, as he came plodding into the inn door, his sea chest flowing behind him in a hand barrow, a tall, strong, heavy, nut-brown man, his tarry pigtail falling over the shoulder of his soiled blue coat, his hands ragged and scarred, with black broken nails, and the saber cut across one cheek, a dirty, livid white. I remember him looking round the cover and whistling to himself as he did so, then breaking out in that old sea song he sang so often afterwards. 15 men on a dead man's chest, yo ho ho, and a bottle of rum. In the high, tottering voice that seemed to have been tuned and broken at the capstan bars, then he rapped on the door with a bit of a stick like a handspike that he carried, and when my father appeared, called roughly for a glass of rum. This, when it was brought to him, he drank slowly, like a connoisseur, lingering on the taste and still looking about him at the cliffs and up at our signboard. "This is a handy cove," he says at length, "and a pleasant, city-gated grog shop. Much company, mate?" My father told him no. Very little company, the more was the pity. "Well, then," said he, "this is the berth for me. Here, you matey," he cried, "the man who trundled to the barrel, bring him up alongside and help my chest. I'll stay here a bit," he continued. "I'm a plain man. Rum, bacon, and eggs is what I want, and that head up there to watch for ships off. What might you call me?" "You might call me captain." "Oh, I see what you're at there," and he threw down 3 or 4 gold pieces on the threshold. "You can tell me when I've worked through that," he says, looking as fierce as a commander. And indeed, as bad as his clothes were, and coarsely as he spoke, he had none of the appearance of a man who had sailed before the mast, but seemed like a mate or a skipper, accustomed to being obeyed or to strike. The man who came through with the barrow told us the mail had set him down in the morning before at the Royal Gorge, and that he had inquired what inns there were along the coast. Hearing ours was well spoken of, I suppose, and described as lonely, had chosen it from the others for his place of residence. And that was all we could learn of our guest. He was a very silent man by custom. All day he hung around the cove upon the cliffs with a brass telescope. All evening he sat in the corner of the parlor next to the fire and drank rum and water very strong. Mostly he would not speak when spoken to, only look up sudden and fierce and blow through his nose like a foghorn. And we and the people who came about our house soon learned to let him be. Every day when he came back from his stroll, he would ask if any seafaring men had gone by along the road. At first we thought it was the want of company of his own kind that made him ask this question. but at last we began to see that he was desirous to avoid them. When a seaman did put up at the Admiral Benbow, as now and then some did, by making the coast for a Bristol, he would look in at him on the curtained door before he entered the parlor, and he was always sure to be as silent as a mouse when any such was present. For me, at least, there was no secret about the matter, for I was, in a way, a sharer of his alarms. He had taken me aside one day and promised me a silver fourpenny on the first of every month, if only I would keep my weather eye open for a seafaring man with one leg, and let him know the moment he appeared. Often enough, when the first of the month came round, and I applied to him for my wage, he would only blow through his nose at me and stare me down. But before the week was out, he was sure to think better of it, and bring me my fourpenny pence, and repeat his orders to look out for the seafaring man with one leg. How that personage haunted my dreams, I need scarcely tell you. On stormy nights, when the wind shook the four corners of the house and the surf roared along the cove and up the cliffs, I would see him in a thousand forms, with a thousand diabolical expressions. Now the leg would be cut off at the knee, now at the hip. Now he was a monstrous kind of creature who had never had but one leg, and that in the middle of his body. To see him leap and run to pursue me over a hedge and ditch was the worst of my nightmares. And altogether, I paid pretty dear for my monthly fourpenny piece, in the shape of these abominable fancies. But though I was terrified by the idea of the seafaring man with one leg, I was far less afraid of the captain himself than anybody else who knew him. There were nights when he took a deal more rum and water than his head would carry, and then he would sometimes sit and sing his wicked old wild sea songs, minding nobody. But sometimes he would call for glasses round and force all the trembling company to listen to his stories, or bear a chorus to his singing. Often I'd heard the house shaking with yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum, all the neighbors joining in for dear life with the fear of death upon them, and each singing louder than the other to avoid remark. For in these fits, he was the most overriding companion ever known. He would slap his hand on the table for silence all around. He would fly up in a passion of anger at a question, or sometimes because none was put. And so he judged the company was not following his story. Nor would he allow anyone to leave the inn until he had drunk himself sleepy and reeled off to bed. His stories were what frightened people worst of all. Dreadful stories they were about hangings and walking the plank, and storms at sea, and the dry tortugas, and the wild deeds of places in the Spanish Main. But by his own account, he must have lived a life among some of the wickedest men that God ever allowed upon the sea. And the language in which he told these stories shocked plain country people almost as much as the crimes that he described. My father was always saying the inn would be ruined, for people would soon cease coming down there to be tyrannized over and put down, and sent shivering to their beds. But I really believe his presence did us good. People were frightened at the time, but on looking back, they rather liked it. It was a fine excitement in a quiet country life, and there was even a party of the younger men who pretended to admire him, calling him true sea dog and real old salt, and such like names, and saying there was a sort of man who made England terrible at sea. In one way, indeed, he bade fair to ruin us, for he kept on staying week after week, and at last month after month, so all the money had been long exhausted, and still my father never plucked up the heart to insist on having more. If he ever mentioned it, the captain blew through his nose so loudly that you might say he roared and stared my poor father out of the room. I've seen him wringing his hands after such a rebuff, and I'm sure the annoyance and the terror he lived in must have greatly hastened his early and unhappy death. All the time he lived with us, Captain made no change whatsoever in his dress, but to buy some stockings from a hawker. One of the cocks of his hat having fallen down, he let it hang from that day forth. Though it was a great annoyance when it blew, I remember the appearance of his coat, which he patched up himself in his room, and which, before the end, was nothing but patches. He never wrote or received a letter. He He never spoke with any but the neighbors, and with these, for the most part, only when drunk on rum. The great sea chest none of us had ever seen open. He was only once crossed, and that was towards the end, when my poor father was far gone in decline that took him off. Dr. Livesley came late one afternoon to see the patient, took a bit of dinner from my mother, and went into the parlor to smoke a pipe until his horse should come down from the hamlet, for we had no stabling at the old Benmow. I followed him in, and I remember observing the contrast of the neat bright doctor with his powder white as snow and his bright black eyes, and his pleasant manners, made with the coitish country folk, and above all, with that filthy, heavy, blended scarecrow of a pirate of ours. Far gone in rum, sitting with his arms on the table. Suddenly he, the captain, that is, began to pipe up his eternal song. 15 men on the dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum. Drink and the devil had gone for the rest, yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum. At first I supposed the dead man's chest to be identical big box of the one upstairs in the front room, and the thought had been mingled in my nightmares with that of the one-legged seafaring man, but by this time we had all long ceased to pay any particular notice to the song. It was new that night, but nobody but Dr. Livesley, and on him I observed it did not produce an agreeable effect, for he looked up the moment quite angrily before he went out on his talk to the old tailor, the gardener, a new cure for rheumatics. In the meantime, the captain gradually brightened up his own music, and at last flapped his hand upon the table before him in a way we all knew to mean silence. The voices stopped at once, all but Dr. Livesley's. He went on before speaking clear and kind, drawing briskly at his pipe between every word or two. The captain glared at him for a while, flapped his hand again, glared still harder, and at last broke out with a villainous low oath, "Silence there, between decks!" "Were you addressing me, sir?" says the doctor, when the ruffian told him, with another oath, that this was so. "I have only one thing to say to you, sir," replies the doctor, "that if you keep on drinking rum, the world will soon be quiet of a very dirty scoundrel." The old fellow's fury was awful. He sprang to his feet, drew and opened his sailor's clasp knife, balancing it on the palm of his hand, and threatened to pin the doctor to the wall. The doctor never so much as moved. He spoke to him as before, over his shoulder and in the same tone of voice, rather high so that all the room might hear, but perfectly calm and steady. "If you do not put that knife away this instant in your pocket, I promise upon my honor you shall hang at the next assizes." Then followed a battle of looks between them. But the captain soon knuckled under and put up his weapon and resumed his seat, grumbling like a beaten dog. "And now, sir," continued the doctor, "since I now know there's such a fellow in my district, you may count I'll have an eye upon you day and night. I am not a doctor only. I am a magistrate, and if I catch breath of a complaint against you, if it's only for a piece of incivility like tonight's, I'll take effectual means to have you hunted down and routed out of this. Let that suffice." Soon after Dr. Livesley's horse came to the door, he rode away, but the captain held his peace that evening, and for many evenings to come.